This is a recording of the rulemaking hearing held by the Federal Election Commission on September 17, 2008. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Special session of the Federal Election Commission for Wednesday, September 17, 2008 will please come to order. I'd like to welcome everyone to the Commission's hearing on the proposed rule regarding the disclosure of information about contributions bundled by lobbyists, registrants, and their PACs. They will discuss the notice of proposed rulemaking on lobbyist and registrant bundling, which was published in the Federal Register on November 6, 2007. NPRM explained and sought comment on the proposed rule to implement the provisions of the Honest Leadership and Open Government Act of 2007 regarding the disclosure of information about bundled contributions provided by lobbyists, registrants, and their PACs to certain political committees. I'd like to thank all the people who took the time and effort to comment on the proposed rules, and in particular those who appear as witnesses at this hearing to give us the benefit of their practical experience and expertise on issues raised by the proposed rules. I'd like to describe briefly the format we will be used that we'll use today. We expect to have a total of six witnesses, which have been divided into two panels. Each panel will last for 1.5 hours, and there will be a short break between panels. Each witness will have about 5 minutes to make an opening statement. We have a light system at the witness table to help you keep track of your time. The green light will start to flash when you have 1 minute left. The yellow light will go on when you have 30 seconds left, and the red light means it's time to wrap up your remarks. Balance of the time is reserved for questioning by the commission. For each panel, we'd like to have at least one round of questions and a second, if time permits, from the commissioners, the general counsel, and the staff director. The format I prefer is more of a free form. Particularly in this case, where I think the comments have very much framed up the issues. When we get on an issue, drill down. So I'll recognize commissioners as we go. I don't like to do the divide it up by commissioner, because once we get on a topic, it's awkward sometimes for witnesses to go back when another commissioner wants to revisit the topic a half hour later. The first panel. But before we get to the panel, I understand that at least one of my colleagues would like to make an opening statement. And after that, we'll turn to the first panel, which consists of Don Simon here on behalf of Democracy 21, Joe Sandler, I believe in his individual capacity, not on behalf of any particular client, and Tim Jenkins on behalf of the Coalition for Tax Equity. Generally, we follow the alphabet. So Mr. Jenkins would go first. But before your opening statements, any commissioners would like to make opening statements? Mr. Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your indulgence. Well, I'm excited. For most of my career, I've worked on issues of government transparency. And for most of my tenure here at the FEC, as many people in the room know, I've been an advocate for a greater disclosure of the fundraising practice known as bundling. Not to ban the practice, just to shed more light on it. For if the public has the right to know every time an individual gives $200 to a campaign, then it seems plain to me that the public has the right to know when an individual provides a campaign with tens, if not hundreds, of thousands of dollars due to his or her networking abilities and fundraising prowess. Now, the rule that we will issue at the end of this process is probably not the rule that I was imagining when I began thinking about this 5 years ago. For one thing, I envisioned a rule that would require disclosure of all bundlers above a certain level, not just those involved in lobbying. But the bill's advocates in Congress made certain compromises in order to get this provision passed. And without those compromises, the bundling disclosure provision probably wouldn't have passed. And without that statutory mandate, we probably wouldn't be here today, because I've been working on this for 5 years, and I've, you know, never managed to launch a rulemaking yet until we had that statutory mandate behind us. So I think it's important to note that we're here to implement a statute. And I anticipate a lot of discussion at this hearing about the meaning of the precise words adopted in that statute. The result may not be perfect in my eyes, or perhaps in anybody else's, although maybe for different reasons, but it will advance the goal of transparency. And I'm optimistic that the result will be one that all of us here and the law's advocates in Congress will all be able to be proud of.
I don't believe there's any other opening statements from the commissioners. So turn to the witnesses. Mr. Jenkins.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, thank you for the opportunity to testify today on the regulations relating to bundling in the Honest Leadership and Open Government Act of 2007. I am here on behalf of the Coalition for Tax Equity, which is an association that we formed in early 1990. It's comprised of corporations and trade associations active in the federal public policy arena. Over the years, the coalition has been very involved in the high-profile and controversial debates in the areas of the gift rules in the mid-90s and the various Lobbying Disclosure Act provisions that started in the mid-90s and were amended in 1998. And most recently, we were actively involved with member offices and the leadership with the HLOGA on the gift and LDA provisions. The coalition is a registered lobbying entity, but it has sort of evolved into a fundamentally a compliance council operation. And throughout the existence, what we've advocated for are rules that are clear and concise, that are unambiguous, and in harmony with related provisions. And while some of the members may disagree with some of the policies, including some of the provisions in the new ethics rules, the goal and the guiding principle for the coalition is to assure that these provisions are clear and concise and that they're subject to full compliance. And you'll see that these principles underlie what I put in my written testimony and what I'll talk about today. While there are several areas that you all sought comment on, I want to focus on two provisions today in the limited five-minute time. The first is how you define the scope of designations or other means of recognizing or, quote, giving credit for purposes of establishing who is a bundler. And that's really, first and foremost, irrespective of this issue of the threshold. But so you sort of have the two tiers, and that's the first one. And then the second is, how are you going to allocate credit for bundling when you have the very, very common situation of multiple fundraisers involved in a single event? With regard to the first element, how to define a bundler, the Commission proposed rule cites the sort of current conduit rule as one example where you collect and forward earmark contributions. And then you have the second one, which is sort of more troublesome, and we're kind of breaking new ground with it, where an entity does not forward the earmark contribution, but that entity gets credited with raising the contribution. And the proposed rule in the statute talks about records, designations, or other means of recognizing. As noted in the written testimony, the first item is pretty straightforward, and it's already a well-established concept in the whole conduit and intermediary area. And I think you could embody that or fold that into the bundling regulations by basically not including the last exception to that definition, which is essentially when you become a designated agent of a candidate committee. The example most often is where you lend your name as a steering committee member to an event, and even though you may collect and forward those contributions, under that regulation, you are not an intermediary or a conduit, not required to register and report. What I'm suggesting is you don't change that regulation for that purpose, but you do knock out the exception for purposes of whether somebody's a bundler. So you're on a steering committee, you lend your name to the effort. Regardless of whether you collect and forward those collections, you would be a bundler, again, subject to the threshold. The second item is far more complicated, and I think potentially the scope of extensive confusion and legal entanglement. And, you know, at this level, which is how else do you assign credit? I urge the Commission not to just give instructive examples, which is noted in one of my colleagues here today, but instead to be as prescriptive as possible, to cite to as many examples as you can in the regulations to essentially eliminate ambiguity. And I frankly think it should establish kind of a de facto safe harbor if you're outside the confines of those definitions. So in my testimony, I list some examples of what does qualify, and I want to move now to this existence of the multiple fundraisers. Your example of three lobbyists who raised $20,000 with no apparent record or designation, there really is no other conclusion to reach than that none of those people have tripped the thresholds. In the real world, credit is given where credit is earned, and the committees do not assign to each of those fundraisers the full amount that is raised. So And you're a record-keeping entity. It's about accuracy. In my written testimony, I cite two examples where the record could be incredibly misleading, where you have 20 people raising $5,000 versus this three at 20. So I urge the commission to, in the absence of designations or other objective criteria, you have multiple fundraisers, I urge the commission to basically split that up evenly and do the math, and if you don't trip the 15,000, you're not a bundler. That 15,000 was there for a reason. I look forward to answering questions on that issue, and particularly on the legislative history that's been cited. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Sandler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the commission. I appreciate the opportunity to appear today. I'm with the law firm of Sandler, Reif & Young, not appearing on behalf of any client, but as my colleague Nir Reif and I is also here as practitioners representing candidates and party committees and who engage responsible to those clients for advising them with respect to FEC reporting and often preparing the reports. I just want to quickly address three points raised by the NPRM. I'd be happy to answer any questions after that. First, with respect to reporting frequency, it appears that there's a consensus among the commenters that, and the sponsors too, for that matter, that monthly filers should be required to file quarterly. And the reason is otherwise you're going to miss a lot of disclosure because for monthly filers, if they were required to file monthly and that was the covered period, a number of bundlers would not meet the applicable threshold. Second, with respect to the issue of double reporting, we do not believe that the same contribution should be disclosed, a bundled contribution should be disclosed in more than one report. So that if somebody is required to file quarterly, they should also not be required to file a semiannual report. But we agree with the point made by Mr. Simon and some of the other commenters that the threshold should be applied on a semiannual basis. So that, and to take an example from Don, that if somebody raised $20,000 in the first quarter, $5,000 in the second quarter, they should be required to disclose the $5,000 in the second quarterly report. They should only be required to file a quarterly report, but they should be required to disclose the $5,000. We think the commission has the authority to do that by defining the covered period for purposes of the threshold as the semiannual period. And then the third point with respect to non-listed employees of registered entities. This is a tricky issue, and there's actually have thought about this some more since we submitted our comments more than a year ago. On the one hand, we have the situation, which we didn't really address and contemplate in our comments, where the CEO of a company that has retained in-house lobbyists and or hires an outside lobbying firm, raises contributions for a candidate or party committee, and is credited with that. But in the typical case, the CEO themselves is not going to be an individually listed registered lobbyist because they won't have triggered the 20% threshold under the Lobbying Disclosure Act. Nonetheless, we recognize that the intent of the law is clear in that situation, that the raising of that money by the CEO should be disclosed. And so we agree with the concept that put forward by the sponsors and in some of the comments that when the company is really the entity that's retained registered lobbyists has bundled contributions, that fact should be disclosed. On the other hand, we are talking about a reporting system here. There has to be some objective criteria. And there, of course, every individual who has bundled contributions, when they're reported, you know, they have to list their occupation and employer. The mere fact, and the sponsors make this clear, that somebody's employer is a firm that retains lobbyists doesn't mean that, you know, they should be reported. We would encourage the commission to consider coming up with some kind of objective criteria to determine, so that obviate the need for determining whether somebody's acting as the agent of their employer and having bundled those contributions. Possibly there should be a presumption that, you know, senior officers of the company, individuals involved in the government relations division of a company should be, you know, presumed to be acting on behalf of, or acting as agents, rather, for their company for purposes of the disclosure. But and that's not by any means an exhaustive approach, but there should be some objective criteria rather than leaving it to some sort of case-by-case investigation. Those are the main points we wanted to make, and be happy to answer any questions after Mr. Simon's remarks.
Thank you. Mr. Simon?
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on behalf of Democracy 21, which was a strong supporter of the Honest Leadership and Open Government Act passed last year. The law is considered one of the most significant ethics reforms enacted since Watergate. HLOGA was enacted in part as a response to the Abramoff scandal and is intended not to restrain the activity of lobbyists, but rather to expose those activities to greater disclosure and public scrutiny. This is particularly the case with regard to how lobbyists use money to buy access and influence. There is not only better disclosure of campaign contributions made by lobbyists themselves, but also for the first time disclosure of other kinds of contributions and disbursements made by lobbyists, for example, to pay the costs of events to honor members or funds donated to entities controlled by or named for members. In this vein, one of the most important and long overdue reforms is disclosure of bundling by lobbyists. Bundling, as we all know, is an established practice in Washington and is surely one of the most significant ways in which lobbyists provide help to congressional and presidential candidates. Lobbyists bundle campaign contributions in sums that dwarf federal contribution limits. Indeed, in this year's presidential campaign, for the first time, we saw million-dollar bundlers. Candidates give and lobbyists take credit for raising such large sums of money. It's only reasonable for the public to believe that bundling is a technique used by lobbyists to curry favor with federal officials and to influence government decisions. Now, HLOGA does not prohibit bundling nor even regulate it. It simply requires that when done by lobbyists and lobbying organizations, it be disclosed. This is modest reform in its aims and means, but very significant in terms of the public benefit if properly implemented. Now, there is simply no doubt as to what your guide star should be in writing the implementing regulations. In an unusual statutory provision, Congress took care to tell you not just to write regulations, but how to do it. Section 434I5D instructs that the commission, quote, shall provide for the broadest possible disclosure of lobbyist bundling that's consistent with the law. This is not legislative history. This is the law itself. And it means that in any instance in which you have a choice between two plausible alternatives, you must choose the one which provides for better and broader disclosure. Now, members of Congress are, in substantial part, the ones being regulated here, since the disclosure obligation falls on them. And they have told you that they want the regulations to insist on the broadest possible disclosure. The legislative history here is, however, consistent with this overall mandate and is itself unusually helpful as well, since the principal sponsors of the bundling provision in both houses took care to provide detailed floor statements prior to enactment which specifically address and answer many of the questions raised in the NPRM. Senators Feingold and Obama were the principal Senate sponsors of the separate bundling legislation that was included in HLOGA, and Representative Ann Holland was the lead author of the bundling language in the House bill. The floor statements by these three lead sponsors provide clear and explicit guidance on a number of the questions before you. For instance, there's no doubt that the sponsors intend that fundraising events hosted by lobbyists fall within the bundling disclosure requirement. Senators Feingold and Obama discussed this at length in their floor colloquy. Nor is there any doubt that the total amount raised at such events should be attributed to each lobbyist co-host. as Senator Feingold said in the colloquy with Senator Obama, quote, when two or more lobbyists are jointly involved in providing the same bundled contributions, as for instance in the case of a fundraising event co-hosted by two or more lobbyists, then each lobbyist is responsible for and should be treated as providing the total amount raised at the event. So too, the statutory touchstone for when fundraising constitutes bundling is whether a candidate gives credit to the lobbyist for raising a certain amount of money received by the candidate. Credit is credit, and it doesn't have to be formalized to be real. As Representative Van Hollen said in his House floor statement, the credit that is attributed to the lobbyist does not need to be memorialized in writing or captured within a database or any other contribution tracking system to trigger the reporting requirement. The Senate legislative history is consistent with this. Senator Obama said on the floor, the credit doesn't have to be written or recorded because the definition includes other means of recognizing that a certain amount of money has been raised. So if a lobbyist tells a candidate that he has raised a certain amount of money for a campaign, the lobbyist should be credited with that amount of bundling and the bundling must be reported, close quote. Now these are just two examples, the treatment of fundraising events and the informal system of crediting contributions, just two examples of areas where the Commission's statutory responsibility is to provide for the broadest possible disclosure. I urge you to keep that statutory standard foremost in your mind as you complete the process of writing these rules. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the Commission? I could go first and pick the issue. Okay. So many narrow issues. Let's talk about what it means to credit first. I read a statement of Senator Feingold that says the committee must actually know, not just be aware that maybe somebody raised money. And it seems to me that there could be, and this is a distinction I think Mr. Elias, who's on the second panel, was trying to raise, that there's a difference between crediting and simply keeping track of fundraising. And it may be a metaphysical distinction when we get done the rulemaking, it may not be a difference, but professional fundraisers keep records all the time of who raises what and perhaps who sponsored an event for their fundraising purposes, but that's not necessarily the same as crediting, or is it? That's my question. Is it, what is crediting, what isn't crediting? Mr. Simon.
Yeah, you know, to me, and I think, again, this is clear in the discussion of this provision by the sponsors, crediting is knowledge. If the member knows that a lobbyist has raised $100,000 for him, he's gotten that money, then it's not required, as I think is clear in the floor statements I just read, it's not required that the member have some formalized written record-keeping system. The knowledge by the member of the fact that the lobbyist raised the money is sufficient to trigger the reporting requirement.
So you see the emphasis on the knowledge of the member.
Yeah, I do.
What if the member doesn't know?
Well, the member or the committee. And the statute is clear that the credit has to be given by either the member or the committee. So if the fundraising director of the committee knows who's been bringing in contributions, that would also suffice.
Same question. Does anyone else have any thoughts on whether or not crediting needs to be written?
I actually agree that where there's a record or designation, and that includes a list that the candidate committee representative might maintain, that probably meets the statute. And I think if you're a host or a co-host on an event, if you host a fundraiser in your entities, if you're a corporation or association at your venue or in your home, if you're a registered lobbyist in your personal residence, to me that should be credit. I think where the member doesn't know and there is no record or designation and there's no reference on an invitation to somebody who is a host or a steering committee member, that you have to draw the line there. And frankly, I think the issue is less significant if the multiple lobbyist issue is dealt with the way it should be per the statute. That $15,000 threshold means something, and if, in case I don't get a chance to deal with the legislative history, it's very important that the legislative history, I would sort of characterize as a legislative history wish list. Those members' approaches were directly rejected in the final package. The bill that came out of the Senate that was the Obama, that Obama authored, had the lobbyists disclosing on their quarterly reports, and it had the word aggregate included in the statute. The House side, the same thing for Mr. Van Hollen. It was going to be part of an LDA disclosure by the lobbyists. The LDA is an estimating regime. And when the final product, which was a compromise sort of conference, behind the scenes conference between the House and the Senate, emerged, it was very, very different. It was an FEC disclosure, which is all about accuracy and transparency, and it was a mandate imposed not on the lobbyists but on candidates. And it's going to be a schedule to their otherwise accounting disclosure, which is their quarterly reporting. So I really think all these references to the authors, you know, it's certainly signals their intent, but their four corners sort of drafting was directly rejected in the final product.
Could I respond to that? I mean, one always wants to denigrate the legislative history. That doesn't accord with your position. But, you know, this is legislative history as much as any other floor statements by the lead sponsors and authors of a provision prior to enactment of the final bill. These were comments made not on the earlier provisions, but these were comments made on the provision as adopted. Now, it is true that the earlier versions of the bill did impose the reporting obligation on the lobbyist and as part of their LDA reports, but in going through the process, people realized there was this conceptual issue, which is the lobbyist would know whether he was out soliciting the money, but people raised the very good point that the lobbyist wouldn't necessarily know if the money was received by the candidate, and he certainly wouldn't know whether the candidate was giving the lobbyist credit for having raised the money. And I think that was the principal reason that in the final law, the reporting obligation was shifted from the lobbyist to the candidate, because the candidate does know exactly those two things, whether he's received the money, and the candidate knows whether he is crediting those funds to the lobbyist. So that was the reason for the shift. But again, if you go back and read the floor statements made by the principal sponsors on the final bill before enactment, they talk about these issues. And they reaffirm that on these sorts of questions we're discussing in terms of fundraising events and co-hosting and so forth, the final bill as adopted was to reflect the intent that they stated.
Can I ask a follow-up on the lines of the knowledge of the member? It doesn't necessarily have to be a written crediting, as I understand your question. Mm-hmm. On the enforcement side, how does that play out here in three different contexts? Say RAD sends a letter saying that maybe have a question about the report, or let's say they're audited, what sort of documentation would there be, if any? And then let's say we end up in an enforcement context. How do we know what the member knew, short of deposing the member, which we could do, but then how do we know the member really knew what he knew and when he knew it?
Yeah, no, that's a fair question. I think your job here is to set a standard, and then I think you have the right to expect the members to comply with that standard. There are lots of provisions of the campaign finance laws where there's always the possibility for secret exchanges where it would be hard for the commission to know exactly what was going on, and hard in that sense to enforce the law. I mean, the coordination rules are rife with that in terms of whether substantial discussions have occurred or whether material information was passed, but your obligation is to set rules, and I think particularly where the onus of the rules falls on the member of Congress, I think you have the right to expect that they'll comply with them. Now, you know, if a lobbyist walks up to a member and says, I raised $100,000 for you. Here's how it's going to come in. And the member says, that's terrific. I really, really appreciate it. But never writes it down. You know, the member knows the money was raised by the lobbyist, and I think the member has given the lobbyist credit. And if you write a rule that excludes that transaction from disclosure because the credit was never memorialized or written down, I think you're opening a huge gap in the coverage of the law. And I just don't think that would be consistent with the statutory directive to provide for the broadest possible disclosure.
Well, on that, though, it's the broadest possible disclosure consistent with, you know, the subsection, the activity covered by the section. So
yeah,
it begs the question, because if it's not activity covered by the statute, you don't have to, you'll go beyond what the statute requires.
Right.
It doesn't say broader than the statutory language. That would be.
Right. That kind of reading just collapses that standard back into the other language of the law and attributes no weight to it. And I think Congress was clearly intending to say something to the commission by putting that directive in the statute. And again, you know, statutory language, and I think this is an example of it here with this definition of bundling, is certainly susceptible. The language itself is certainly susceptible of two different meanings. And in that situation, I think the import of that statutory directive is to choose the one that provides for the broader disclosure.
So do you agree with the thought that the statute does not mandate that we write a reg that reaches out to non-written crediting, or does the statute mandate that we that our reg does cover?
I think the statutory language, in light of the subsection D directive, mandates that you cover credit even if it's unwritten.
I think you have to draw the line where there is no record designation or other means of recognizing. And I think in terms of opening up a can of worms, you would be basically left with an unenforceable statute, as you pointed out, Mr. Chairman. So I think that while I agree that you should be pretty broad in defining exactly what does constitute bundling, and certainly the Bush Pioneer and Ranger model is a no-brainer in terms of people getting tracking numbers, if you're sign up to be on the steering committee, and in order to be a steering committee member, you have to agree to raise $10,000. I think that's sufficient in terms of a record. But the old slap on the back because you walk by a member of Congress and say, hey, you know, you'll be glad to know I'm going to raise $20,000 for you. So what? I mean, I may or may not do it. And in the absence of some way that that member can quantify the amount and the fact that it did happen, then I think you can't subject the member to that kind of a standard.
I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure I say it was unenforceable. It seems to be so broad, though, as to be an administrative potential problem, and exposes it. I'm not saying necessarily the subjective knowledge is unenforceable. I'm getting at the practical application, though. But you use language that tracks the statute, which is records designations or other means of recognizing that a certain amount of money has been raised by the person. Records is written. We agree that would be a writing. Designations would be a writing. It's the or other means of recognizing. And that's where I'm hung up on written versus this having it.
Yeah, let me say two things. I think recognition is knowledge. I mean, I think that's what the word means, and the root of recognition is cognition, which is knowledge. But let me make another point. I mean, Joe said before that, you know, in the year since he filed the written comments, he's thought about this more. And actually, I had one additional point on this that I did not include in our written comments, but I think it's a useful analogy here in a very closely related area. The commission has longstanding rules regarding earmarked contributions that are transmitted by a conduit or intermediary. And that's based on a statutory directive governing earmarking. And that's what the statute says. It talks about earmarking. Now, in the rule that the commission issued, I think, 20 years ago, that defines earmarking, it says, earmarked means a designation, instruction, or encumbrance, whether direct or indirect, express or implied, oral or written, which results in all or any part of a contribution or expenditure being made to a designated candidate. So the commission took the concept of earmarking, the statutory term earmarking, and I think appropriately expanded it to include implied or expressed, oral or written forms of earmarking. So if somebody gives a check to a political committee and says, it just says, I want this check to go to candidate A, it's never written down. That's an earmarked contribution. Now, there may be enforcement issues about how the commission would know that that earmarking designation was attributed to that check, but nonetheless, it's appropriately, the oral designation is appropriately treated as earmarking. And I think, again, the situation here is analogous.
Kind of, but that gets to the heart of contribution limits, and earmarking money is an end run around the limits, which is a central issue under FECA. And you usually infer the earmark, you know, from facts to timing, that kind of thing. This is a disclosure regime, and I'm not so, I understand the point, but that, is there a distinction between the need to really go after earmarks versus this in a disclosure regime, which to me shouldn't necessarily have such probing fact-finding issues, or at least some could argue that.
I mean, I recognize the point between the difference between contribution limits and disclosure, but I think this is important disclosure, and I think if you say that unwritten forms of crediting and recognition are outside the scope of the disclosure responsibility, you are really walking into the teeth of not only direct statements by the principal sponsors in both houses on this specific point, but you're also walking into the teeth of the statutory directive, because I do not think that you're then providing for the broadest possible disclosure. And, you know, I think that just gets the commission into trouble.
Mr. Sandler, you kind of grabbed the mic, and then
I just briefly, Mr. Chairman, I think the distinction here largely dissolves in practical application. The most committees, one way or the other, have a way of tracking people who have raised money for the committee and tracking credit. This is not a business in which people should, you know, leave this to memory. Because there are consequences to it in terms of how, you know, people are recognized and rewarded, talking a state party or a candidate, and acknowledged at the events and that kind of thing. So I think that that while Don certainly has the intent of the statute right, in reality, the committees that are and candidates that are responsible for this are gonna keep track of it. Do in fact keep track of it. That's just how it works in real life.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. I think the record, the sort of Bush pioneer model is one model, but as Joe said, I think most of these situations are going to be accounted for. And the people that are out there raising money, they absolutely want to get credit for it. So you have sort of an institutional, if you will, imperative there where, you know, getting the recognition is something that almost invariably is done, because if I say I want to get raise $10,000 for a senator, I'm not going to leave to chance that senator acknowledging or knowing that I did it. It's in my interest to be credited with that. So I think the concern comes where money is raised and it really doesn't have any nexus back to the member, and the member is then somehow required to go back and figure it out. And I think, so I would suggest that you use the record designations or other means and define the other means as broadly as you can, but do it objectively and, again, prescriptively. So 10, 15, 20 situations that would be enough to give the member knowledge. And then other than that, I think the member's got to be off the hook.
You know, I agree with Joe's point that in the normal case, this is tracked carefully by committees, and that lobbyists are plenty interested in making sure they're getting the recognition and they're getting the title or the invitation or, you know, or whatever. So in the normal case, this issue kind of takes care of itself. I just want to caution you, though, about opening the door to, at the very time and in the statute with the very intent of surfacing bundling and making it transparent and publicly disclosed, I just caution you against opening the door to the creation of a kind of underground bundling where because things just are not written down, even though all the other attributes or elements of the bundling are apparent, that the disclosure responsibilities can be evaded.
Actually, just one final question on this point before I don't want to hog up the whole time, but let's just, if you can indulge me, assume the subsection that says it needs to be the broadest possible reporting, Mr. and Mr. Simon, was not in the statute. So let's just focus on the records designations or other means of recognizing that a certain amount of money has been raised by the person language. That standing alone, can that be read more than one way? Meaning, can that be read to mean written only versus written and oral communications?
Well, it is being read to mean that by other commenters. I think.
I understand. I know that.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I think that recognizing is knowing. If the member knows that the lobbyist raised the money for him, he recognizes that's a form of recognizing the lobbyist bundled the contributions. I think the language on its own supports that interpretation. I think in light of the legislative history and the statutory directive, it's a very strong case.
I understand supports that reading. What I'm saying is could the language be read another way, because it doesn't simply say records designations or recognition of or recognizing. It says other means of recognizing.
Yeah, I think that's
so the means is a mental note.
I think a means of recognizing is knowing.
Okay.
Once again, I want to get to this legislative history. The statute, as everybody knows, trumps legislative history. Emphatically trumps legislative history. This is another example where the language that the authors who are very, very outspoken in the on the floor statements was rejected. The Senator Obama provision that emerged from the Senate used the word formal or informal credit in lieu of the language that emerged, which was record designations or other means of recognizing. So I think irrespective of this expansive interpretation language, which is then, of course, qualified by, quote, consistent with the law or the statute, irrespective of that, I think there is some significance to the transition from what the authors originally wrote and where it ended up, and I think the fact that informal credit is just not subject to enforcement, or as you suggest, it's very difficult to enforce and would require, you know, multiple subpoenas potentially. I think you have to look at the evolution of the House and Senate bills and the final product, as Commissioner Weintraub said, you know, recognize that it was a compromise. And it was a compromise because they wanted to get it passed. And the more difficult and the more stringent provisions just were not going to fly at the end of that session when they were crunched on time.
Yeah, I'd like to follow up on the same line of questioning, because I think that you started out with one of the key issues that is a source of controversy amongst the witnesses. I was actually pretty gratified when I read the comments, because overall there was a lot of agreement from the commenters that, in general, the proposed rule pretty much does what it needs to do to implement the statute. I mean, you know, even you, Mr. Simon, I think we're basically happy with it, although there's a couple of issues where you disagree with some of your some of the other commenters. I'd like to get back to the practicalities of this. And maybe I should start with just asking Joe and maybe Tim also. I was thinking that this is more of a Joe question, but you may also have some insight on this. How does this work in practice? What do committees do in order to track bundling, and why do they do it? Do they feel they need to do it? Does it help them raise more money to do it? And as you said, you know, are people fighting over the credit so that there actually is a lot of interest in maintaining these kinds of accurate records?
Yes, there's a both for party committees and candidate committees. There's a significant interest in on the part of the raisers to be credited for what they've raised for their efforts with the committee, and also there's a significant incentive on the part of the the candidate committee or the party committee to give credit. So as a practical matter, and as the system is not perfect, and committees may have to adjust and make it more precise and come up with some objective more objective criteria internally to make this work in response to the new regulations. But basically, in most contribution systems that are maintained by candidates and party committees, there is a means of recognizing when somebody has raised the contribution other than, or should be credited with having raised the contribution other than a staff member or a consultant to the committee.
Yeah, I very much agree with that. And actually, as public record would show, I'm a very active fundraiser personally. And host many events. So first and foremost, when I do that, as I suggested earlier, the last thing I want is for the member who should be in attendance at the event and should recognize it. But in the absence of that, if I'm not the venue host, but I'm one of the sponsors on the invitation, I want it to be very, very much known that I've done what I purported I was going to do or suggested I would do. The other thing on the committee side is that the the folks that work for the candidates are paid on a commission basis. They get a percentage generally of the money that is brought in. That requires detailed accounting and records. So I just think this is it's not necessarily a red herring, but I think it's a little bit of a red herring in that, again, subject to the $15,000 threshold issue, which is hugely, I think, material, as long as that $15,000 is the way it should be, in my view, then I don't think this is going to come up very often, because people that are at that level are absolutely going to be sort of accounted for. So you raise $15,000, you're responsible for $15,000 of a $50,000 fundraiser. Three people together raise $50,000. I guarantee you there'll be a record of that. So I think it's, end of the day, I think this is a little bit, as I said, a little bit of a red herring.
If I just may add one point to that, I have no doubt, as I said before, that that's a fair description of current practice. I guess the concern I have is whether the imposition of a new disclosure requirement changes the status quo such that it might then drive at least some bundling to not be written down, or that there might be some incentive to not write it down specifically in order to avoid the disclosure requirement if the commission's rule allows that, and that's why the commission's rule shouldn't allow it. And then I think you probably preserve the fact that as in the normal course it would be written down.
And I guess my question for you, Don, is how big a practical problem do you think this really is going to turn out to be? Because, I mean, I'm just thinking about my own memory capacity, which, you know, ain't as good as it used to be. And I just, based on what people are voluntarily disclosing about their bundling in the last few cycles, you know, you see these very complicated regimes with different levels, 50,000, 100,000, 250,000, and there's hundreds and hundreds of names on these lists of bundlers. It just doesn't seem likely to me that you could maintain that kind of information in your head. That, I mean, there may be a few random people who could do that, but I know I couldn't. So.
Well.
What's the real concern? Are you concerned that, you know, there will be individuals that they just won't want to disclose that particular individual, so they'll make sure they don't have a record of that person? Or, you know, I mean, do you think this is really going to turn into a big loophole?
Well, let me make a couple points. One is, you're describing big league presidential level bundling programs. And you know, that's fine, but bundling occurs in congressional races. There could be much smaller amounts of bundling in a given campaign, and they're not all necessarily as formalized as the extreme presidential bundling activities. But I do think the problem could come up in the context of, you know, specific lobbyists who don't want to be disclosed, or the member doesn't want to disclose that specific lobbyist as a fundraiser, you know, in a kind of Jack Abramoff type situation where a lobbyist becomes radioactive publicly for whatever reason, a member might not want to disclose that that person raised $100,000 for them. And so there just might be a deal where the lobbyist comes up and says, you know, I'm going to raise this money for you, but let's just not write it down. And the member thinks, great, then I don't have to disclose it. And I just don't think the commission should implement a rule that signals that's okay. And I think that's the concern here.
And in the enforcement context, okay, so down the road somebody says, you know what, I know that that lobbyist was out there raising money for that candidate because he asked me for money. He told me to send the money, and he said, don't put any numbers on it. I don't have a tracking number. Just send the check, and they'll know it's, you know, that I raised the money. So let's say, you know, we actually get that complaint in, and then we depose the member or the finance committee chair, whoever it is.
Or the lobbyist.
And the member says, well, but the member has to know about it. I mean, the lobbyist might say, well, yeah, I was out raising money, but I never told him about it. And then the member comes in and says, well, gee, I didn't know anything about it. Then what do we do?
Or the lobbyist might say, yeah, I told him about it. And then you have pretty good evidence that the member knew.
You're right. That would be good evidence, but...
Well, I mean, you know, look, an enforcement case is only as good as the evidence you can develop based on a reason to believe you should conduct an investigation. But, you know, you could have a situation where, you know, you have two parties to this transaction, and one of them admits that there was that discussion.
I don't mean to interrupt, but it's really not just what this agency will do with this rule, this disclosure regime. Let's take a hypothetical. Let's say there is the next Jack Abramoff comes along, and he gets himself caught up in some sort of criminal investigation. And when he's sat down in the chair by law enforcement, they say, what can you give us? And he said, well, I've bundled all these contributions for all these members, and they didn't report any of it. And they say, okay, how do you know that? Well, I ran into these guys on the street, and I said, I raised all this money for you. And you put those members under oath, and they're going to be telling the truth. They don't remember that conversation. I mean, this is assumed that these facts to be true. And then all of a sudden, this guy, who's the outside bad actor, is going to essentially remember conversations that may or may not have happened, but no reasonable person on the other side is going to remember, and they're going to use that lack of reporting to beat that public official over the head. Maybe we don't care about that. Maybe that's just a natural consequence of the statutory language. But to me, it seems like that's not what Congress would have intended, because they wouldn't put that sort of bullseye on their own back. So how do I address that concern?
Well, I think members of Congress did put this reporting obligation on their own back. It had been on the back of the lobbyists, and they took it off the lobbyists' back and put it on their own back, and they made themselves responsible for the reporting. You know, I'm not quite sure what to say about your specific hypothetical. You know, I mean, that just goes to the credibility of the person, the lobbyist under investigation, and the credibility of the information they're giving as part of a plea bargain or whatever. But, you know, I think if there's good evidence that the lobbyist told the member, and the member therefore knew, the member therefore then had a disclosure obligation.
Well, again, I think that in real life, that situation, the lobbyists are always going to want to oversell how much they've done for the member. But in the situation you've cited, if the lobbyist says, yeah, I raised $50,000 for you, the follow-up question is, okay, from whom and when were those checks cut? Last I looked, that's all public information. So that's subject to being verified as well. And if you've got $50,000 worth of personal checks that come in within a condensed time frame, that's pretty good evidence that, yep, the member should have known that. I mean, their campaign committee person's not going to say, wow, this is manna from heaven. Here comes $50,000 we never thought we were going to get, and I don't even know who these people are. It's wonderful. That is something that the campaign is going to know about, and I think using the knowledge standard does not necessarily sort of open up the loophole that Mr. Simon is suggesting it does.
Mr. Reicher.
Let me just say that I take really to heart the command that we have from the legislature to interpret this in the broadest possible way. And so in trying to do it, I'm sure it meant the most reasonable way. But from my own history, being from Nevada all my life and raising money there, it's a little different there than it is here. And we know most everybody who's a candidate. And some of my best friends are on the other side, and it's just the way it is. And in some of these other states, areas. So there really isn't a need in most instances to have a log. You know it. And it's a mental thing. Not that it's unappropriate, it's just that people know if somebody's raising money and how much. And if somebody comes to you and says, I got that 10 grand for you, that's you can put it to the bank. But is that going to be enough? Is knowledge enough if there's no writing? I would ask maybe Mr. Jenkins.
Well, I think if they have the knowledge that I got that $10,000 for you, and that $10,000 is deposited in the bank account, and you know the follow-up question would be, all right, who contributed it? Yes, I think you're right about Nevada. You're right about places like Alabama and Mississippi. It's just sort of the good old boy network. I get all of that, but once they get here to Washington, it's a different dynamic, and I think. These are federal office holders we're talking about. These are folks that are not necessarily back in a state regime where sometimes there's no disclosure of some of these contributions. The thresholds, as you all know, are all over the map. Some are very high. Here it's a pretty tightly regulated regime. And so I think the wink and the nod days are sort of over in terms of whether you can slide $50,000 into a candidate. And I'll go back to the institutional imperative, which is you're only regulating lobbyists and entities that essentially employ or retain them through their PACs. Those are folks that are all about getting the credit. Versus the guy back at home who went to college with you, and this is, a lot of Obama supporters are people like that. They don't have the direct interest in the Washington policy debate. At least not as direct an interest. So I just think that you've got an institutional incentive there or, sort of a structure where this sort of stealth bundling is probably just a complete non sequitur.
Well, let me just say I agree.
The question, though, let me just, if I may, apologize. I didn't mean to direct my comments to the good old boy that is helping a candidate who's not a federal candidate. I'm talking about people who are running for federal office in other states than some of it, just because of the way that people live, they know each other. It's a smaller state. Mm-hmm. It's like even it's a small world here, even in some ways. So I didn't mean to imply that there's anything wrong about it. It's just people haven't necessarily formalized it to the same degree they do here because, by the way we live, it isn't done. So in those particular cases, I'm interested to know if knowledge is enough, even though...
Well, I'll try to answer the question, but I think first the threshold issue is whether the person you're talking about back in Nevada is a covered entity. If the person's a federal registered lobbyist...
Well, let's assume there's lobbyists in Nevada, too.
Oh, no, of course they are. Okay. They're federal... But there are a lot of state lobbyists in Nevada, fewer federal
registered...
Well,
let's talk about the federal.
Yeah, okay. Let's assume that situation. I think in the case where there's a conversation and the lobbyist says to the member, I have raised $10,000 for you, then I think in the enforcement context, if that member is under oath, that member says, well, I remember him saying that. That may impose a higher standard of burden on the member to actually go do the due diligence to make sure it's something that would be disclosed. The $10,000, again, wouldn't be disclosed because it's not $15,000. But let's assume it's $15,000 and none of the funds came from the individual himself or his family. And the facts you just presented, I think in that situation the member would have an obligation, even though it's not written down anywhere. That would be knowledge.
Thanks.
I think you have a follow-up along those lines. How far away from the member's knowledge do we go? And what I'm getting at, it's kind of gone full circle, and it's actually based in part upon one of the questions Commissioner Weintraub had. there are many instances, I think, where the member doesn't actually know necessarily who raised what because they hire professional fundraisers to do that, and professional fundraisers, frankly, track everything under the sun, not to give credit so much as to know who gave what and who met who where, and oh, this person gave money at that event, and therefore maybe we can make a second ask later. They have all kinds of elaborate kind of schemes to and I don't use scheme in a bad way, but just a, you know, spreadsheets and all kinds of things. Records that aren't necessarily housed at the campaign, and campaign folks may not necessarily know about all that. It's the routine sort of documents that fundraisers keep beyond, like, their own lists and their own system to keep track of their own work product versus what they may give to their campaign clients. Is that the kind of stuff that we would reach out and include in this as to knowledge and or something we would be able to obtain either in an audit or in enforcement, or is, because they're private consultants, unless it's in the possession of the campaign, it doesn't count? I'm trying to get at more of a practical question is how this works.
You know, I think that question's answered by the statute, which in the definition of the type 2 bundling says credited. It's not just a matter of the member's knowledge. It says credited by the committee or candidate involved. So, you know, knowledge within the scope of the committee's, the information and knowledge the committee possesses, I think, is covered by the statute.
That's how I read it. It would be the committee.
I agree with that.
I agree with that also. Clearly, with a lot of what we're talking about, that in the practical real world, these things are kept track of. They are kept track of by, particularly in the case of candidates, by outside professional fundraisers, but those have to be treated as records of the committee for this purpose.
But under the contracts, though, with professional fundraisers, not all of the fundraisers' records are the property of the committee, right? I mean, a lot of times they have these deals where they can develop their own list, and some records are really not the committee's records. And I'm getting at whose records are they? And is that something that ends up resulting in accrediting because a fundraiser has been writing something down a certain way in their own internal documents? And then, to take a hypothetical, let's say they have an event at a lobbyist's house, and they just call it, they say the lobbyist is, Joe Smith event, and there's all sorts of people who show up, and the lobbyist doesn't even know really who's at his event in his house because it's really a fundraising event for the campaign. So the lobbyist doesn't think he's getting credit for all that money, nor does the candidate, but the fundraiser writes it down as the Joe Smith event. So now there's a paper trail that shows some kind of crediting that this actually happens. This is kind of how I think people keep records. And my concern is can we discuss this now before we pass a rule and then wake up in 2 years and realize this is a situation before the commission and we don't know what to do with it?
I mean, I guess in our experience with, the candidates' party committees, in that situation, the fundraiser is going to know who raised that money. I mean, if the host fell short and didn't raise the money and the fundraiser had to go out and hustle, they're not going to credit the host with having raised it. I mean, that for the very reason that, the host doesn't deserve the credit for it in that case. But whatever the record is and the knowledge of that fundraiser as to how that money actually came in should be, as Don says, attributed to the committee. Committee should be responsible for tracking it and reflecting it in the required disclosures.
And I actually think in that instance it would be very rare where an agent of the candidate doesn't know. So in that situation, while the candidate may not be knee-deep with the paid consultant, the chief of staff on his or her volunteer lunch hour is probably going to be keeping an eye on that Joe Smith event. So somebody who's, basically an agent of the candidate will have a sense of how much came out of that event, I think, most often.
I just have a quick question that's based on a hypothetical, and I think this hypothetical, based on the information I'm hearing, may be a little bit far-fetched, but I do think it goes to the issue of what is crediting? A lot of our discussion here is how are we going to define that term. Let's imagine a candidate who decides at the outset, for whatever reason, that they are not going to establish any system for tracking or crediting bundlers. Maybe it's because they decide they want to, maybe it's a statement that they want to say that we don't want to have anybody feel like we are beholden to them. Maybe they just feel like we don't want to go through the hassle of the you know, the paperwork burden. It may be an unwise decision, but let's just assume that that's the case. And what happens then if a lobbyist decides that he wants to contact several of his acquaintances and say, I want you to send in checks to this candidate and his or her campaign, and make some sort of notation on the check or include some sort of note letting the candidate know that I'm the one responsible for having raised and generated these contributions. And let's further assume that the total amount that comes in as a result of this lobbyist's efforts exceeds the applicable threshold during the covered period. Now, if these come in from, and again, the candidate made a point that they do not want to, that they're not going to reward this sort of activity, they're not going to, you know, there aren't going to be any special titles or designations. In fact, maybe according to this candidate, they're going to be disappointed that maybe their whole campaign is going to be based on this. I don't want to feel beholden to any big interest. So regardless of the fact that the campaign decided not to make records of this sort of activity, would it be your opinion that this candidate would still have to report these contributions as having been bundled? I guess I'll start with you, Mr. Simon.
Well, I guess I agree with your observation that the hypothetical is far-fetched, but having said that, to me it's analogous to a candidate who, as a matter of, you know, kind of political posture, says, I'm not going to accept any PAC contributions, and a check from a PAC comes in the mail. He's got a remedy, which is to send the check back, and I would say the same thing here. If I think it falls within the statutory definition, I think he recognizes that the money was raised by the lobbyists, and I think if he wants to avoid the obligation to report it, he should just return the checks.
I absolutely agree with Don on that. That clearly is a designation. That's sort of the Bush Ranger Pioneer model, and the remedy is very simple. Just if you want to maintain that public posture, then you got to return those checks.
I agree with that too. And as a matter of fact, in terms of the front end of this, as we sit here today, the Democratic National Committee does not accept contributions raised by lobbyists. So it's checked for, and they make it their business to know who's raised it, and they don't accept it. So that's going on right now.
Okay. Just a couple of other quick questions. Just going to a couple of different areas. Going back to covered period, Mr. Sandler, when I originally read your remarks regarding covered period, I had originally thought that maybe you were arguing that you were taking a position that would have been quite a bit different than Mr. Simon's position, but it sounds like now that while you do not believe that there needs to be an aggregate semi-annual report that a committee would have to submit, that you would still, that the semi-annual period is still a relevant period for determining whether the applicable threshold is triggered.
Yes, we think it would be confusing and misleading, actually, to have two reports reporting the same contributions. But the semi-annual period should be applied for purposes of the threshold, and then people can report what they raised or what was bundled in the actual quarter.
And then the final question I have is just on this issue of agency. You mentioned that in the time that between having submitted your original remarks and this hearing today, that you've come to a different conclusion, that maybe there should be some sort of lines drawn where there's a presumption, maybe a rebuttable presumption, that certain officers within a registrant, they should be considered as having acting on behalf of that registrant. Where do you think those lines should be drawn?
I don't have any firm detailed idea about that, but I think that it would be appropriate to draw them at the senior levels of a company in terms of its officers, and the people who are part of the, you know, the government relations operation of the company would be, you know, would be a logical place to draw the line. I do recognize, you know, that if you just limit it to people who are listed on the LDA report, the CEO of a major company that retains lobbyists and in-house and may hire 25 different lobbying firms here in D.C., clearly the intent of the law is to capture contributions bundled by that individual, even though they themselves are not listed on the LDA.
Mr. Jenkins, yeah, Mr. Senator, do you have any other comments on this issue of agency?
I take a little bit of a different view, and I would actually suggest the commission look to the volunteer exception regulations as maybe your guidepost here. And there they have this, you know, it's per se not volunteer activity if work is performed at the direction of a superior. And I think that concept works better than what's been suggested by Joe. The problem there is lobbying. The lobbyist definition is a very important sort of material element of this statute, and it's hugely important on the LDA side too. And it doesn't take that much for somebody to become a lobbyist. So if you have a senior vice president for government affairs who's not the line lobbyist, you know, there's a government affairs VP and then all these directors of government affairs who do nothing but lobby. That person almost certainly will be a lobbyist under that definition, where it's one or more contacts and 20% of their time generally for that period is engaged in lobbying activity. So if they're supervising and sort of overseeing that activity, that counts as a lobbying activity. So in the CEO situation, there are a lot of CEOs out there that are very politically active. And just because they are CEOs of a company that has people who are engaged in lobbying, I don't think that necessarily is justified by the four corners of the statute. So I agree that the agency concept needs to be embodied in this, but I think it needs to really be more in the context of, are you truly doing it as a volunteer, or are you doing it within the context of your employment? And I think some of that issue, maybe you can look back at your Freddie Mac settlement, and I think some of those issues came out there a little bit too. So I agree the agency has to be covered, but not necessarily as broadly.
Can I ask, I should follow up on that? With respect to the statutory language, where's the hook to hang that hat on as far as an agency concept based upon the statutory language?
Well, I think the fact if somebody is acting in the shoes of another, and I think the contribution in the name of another is a good corollary that was drawn in somebody's testimony, but I think if you're acting on behalf of that registered lobbyist, the short answer is it's not in the statute, but if you're acting on behalf of the registered lobbyist at the direction of a registered lobbyist, if you're the PAC supervisor or the PAC coordinator, not a registered lobbyist, but you essentially are the name and the face of the PAC, then I think that should be disclosed.
Thank you. I just want to follow up on that precise point, because I've been struggling with this concept also. And I think where it comes from in the statute is that there's a requirement that registrants disclose their bundling. And registrants are organizations, and organizations only act through individuals. So at some point you have to figure out, don't we have to figure out who acts for the registrant?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's exactly the right answer, that the agency concept is necessarily embedded in the statutory requirements.
I disagree, and the reason I disagree is that under the Lobbying Disclosure Act, they intended to capture those folks in the gift rules. Actually, maybe the Senate and House gift rules. Those gift rules say that it's prohibited for a member or staffer to accept a gift from a foreign agent, a registered lobbyist, or any entity that employs or retains either, and the interpretation there is anybody who works for them. And we don't have that additional language in this statute.
But we do have the language that says, in addition to lobbyists,
the registrant itself, right, which is an organization. And in that situation, what they say is they basically say the PAC that's connected to the registrant.
But that's a separate category. There's registrants, lobbyists, and PACs
Yeah, the registrants are going to be prohibited sources almost invariably. But they don't talk about anybody who retains or employs. They don't get to that granular level.
So what does a registrant mean that doesn't that adds something to lobbyist and PAC established or controlled by a registrant or lobbyist?
I think it essentially is tied into the PAC part.
It could be
that would make it meaningless.
It could be an organization. We just had an AO about whether a law firm was essentially
a
prohibited
true.
Source or not. Could they have a PAC?
That's
so there could be organizations that are not prohibited sources. Not all organizations are.
That's correct.
But my innocent question was really based more upon PICRA uses the word agent. This statute doesn't, and I was seeing if there's some sort of significance to be drawn from, because Congress sometimes expressly talks about agents, sometimes they don't.
Yeah.
And I just don't want to be in a situation where I'm misreading or overreading significance or underreading significance. That was the point of my question, but we got a whole more beneficial discussion out of it.
If I could make one point in that context, because several of the comments deal with this point, I think it's important to surface it. There are prohibited sources in that they can't make contributions and they can't facilitate contributions, but there are those same prohibited sources can bundle. Now, let me give you an example, and this is explicit in the Commission's facilitation regs, because the facilitation regs. Let me read the language. Say, the following, facilitating the making of contributions, this is 114.2F, facilitating the making of contributions does not include the following activities if conducted by a corporation or labor organization. And it says soliciting contributions to be sent directly to candidates if the solicitation is directed to the restricted class. So a corporation can solicit contributions for a candidate, which and tell the candidate we're getting all these contributions to you from our restricted class. That's bundling. That would have to be disclosed.
And that would be the registrant.
And the registrant.
It would otherwise be prohibited if it wasn't the restricted class, or
right? Right. Exactly. So the registrant, a lobbying organization, which is a corporation, can nonetheless be a bundler under the LDA.
Okay. So that language is not really superfluous. It does have
correct. That's
does
a
have
good
a
point.
Separate. Okay. Thanks.
Mr. Sandler, so. It is conceivable, or are you agreeing that it's possible that a CEO of a corporation may host a fundraiser at his or her home and may even bundle, but as long as, and you're saying that could be covered by the Act?
I think the intent is to cover it, yes, even though that CEO didn't cross the LDA threshold and therefore isn't listed individually as a lobbyist.
But just because the CEO's company hires a lobbyist or has an in-house lobbyist, he would be covered just by virtue of that fact.
Well, the intent, I think that the letter from Senator Obama, Senator Feingold, Congressman Van Hollen does capture what the intent of the law is. And basically what they're saying is that just because somebody works for a lobbying entity doesn't mean he or she is acting on the entity's behalf. The touchstone is who's getting credit for the fundraising. Is it the employer or the employee? If the employee is getting credit and the employee is not a lobbyist, no reporting is required. If the employer is getting credit and the employer is a lobbyist or registrant, there's no question that reporting is required. The question is, since everybody reports their occupation and every bundler has to disclose their occupation and employer, the filer has to keep that information. How do you tell who's getting the credit? I think there should be some kind of objective, ideally criteria or presumptions that the employer is the one getting the credit. You know, in certain situations where the individual doing the bundling is really at the upper reaches of the company or acting. Is in the government relations area.
I think, though, as Mr. Jenkins, I think, suggested, it's conceivable, at least in my mind, that many CEOs are not acting on behalf of their corporation. You know, they may want to open their home and host an event, and they may not even want to be credited for the, the contributions because they're doing it in their personal capacity. And often, in order for it to be credited to the company, they may need to get permission from their board. I mean, there's all kinds of things. They may not want to be attached with some kind of bundling contribution on behalf of their corporation. And I happen to know some CEOs who have done that. So I don't think it's inconceivable at all.
Well, and I also, to your point, I agree that you just, where do you draw the line? It's almost impossible to find a finite demarcation point there. A lot of CEOs have a lot of personal relationships mm-hmm. with members of Congress that sometimes their government affairs people don't even appreciate. They're, you know, titans in their own sort of regard, and members of Congress are pretty highfalutin themselves, so they might have relationships outside of that. I think if you can tie it back to this notion of, is it truly volunteer versus is it something you're doing because you're being directed to do it, or it's within your employment capacity. So back to the Freddie Mac situation, these fundraisers were regular order. And while there may have been a personal relationship, you know, that to basically make the case that that was part of the employment context, I think was pretty easy to do in that situation. But a random CEO fundraiser, and it may be a kind of a non sequitur thing in terms of the members' jurisdiction, what committee are they on, that I just don't think you can draw the line there.
Thank you.
My question goes to the end product of what we're trying to do here is provide data to the public and how usable that might be, and I'd appreciate hearing from all three of you. It goes to the question of how do we allocate, in an example where there's a fundraiser with many hosts. I'll give you a hypothetical with some easy math for my purposes. So we have a fundraiser that raises $150,000. There are 10 hosts. So each of them, there are two ways to attribute that credit, either $15,000 each, which would require disclosure, or $150,000 each. If we take the second approach, it seems to me that the end result would be the public might have an inaccurate view of how much money the lobbyists were actually involved in. If that campaign raised $2 million total, if we use the $15,000 for each lobbyist approach, there would be $150,000 attributable to that set of bundlers, which would reflect the actual amount that came in the door for the campaign. If we use the approach that they each are given credit for the $150,000, which was the total from the fundraiser, it might appear that the lobbyists were responsible for $1.5 million of fundraising for that campaign. That wouldn't be an accurate representation of how much money actually flowed into the campaign, but under the crediting scenario, it might be a representation of how much they were credited with. So is this something we should be concerned about? If it is something we should be concerned about in writing this rule, how do we provide the information to the public in the most usable way? Because I think that is the goal here, is disclosure to the public and providing them, in my view, with accurate information about the role that lobbyists are playing in these campaigns.
There's two different issues. One is you don't want in that situation, if there were 17, or rather 11 hosts sharing it, that none of it gets disclosed. I think that's the concern. As my partner Neil Reeve reminded me, this is a situation where no one's going to expect the numbers disclosed on this to tie back into anything else in the report. In fact, we would suggest that it be a separate schedule in the FEC report, and there's not going to be there's no way to cross-check it. There's no occasion to cross-check. But it certainly wouldn't be inconsistent to say, for purposes of the threshold and even disclosure, you would attribute the entire amount of the fundraiser to the to each of these lobbyists, but there could be some way to asterisk or memo schedule situation so that it's clear that they were all involved in the same event. And I mean, giving that option, the filers wouldn't interfere with the goal that Mr. Simon and the other commenters had advanced.
Let me strongly associate myself with Joe's remarks before Mr. Jenkins goes the other way in this question. This is an important issue. This is an important issue because what's going to happen if you adopt a pro rata methodology is that, you know, the 11th lobbyist will be added as a co-host and none of it gets disclosed. And I urge you not to do that, because it marks an easy path to eviscerating the obligation to disclose bundling conducted through fundraising events. This is example A, exhibit A, of what that statutory language about writing regulations that provide for the broadest possible disclosure means. Because
can I interrupt you? Because my question isn't, I understand what your view is on which one, but what is the public supposed to do with this information then? Because it appears to be out of, it doesn't reflect real dollars.
Yeah,
and one of the things I might want to do as a citizen is understand on a percentage basis or how much in proportion a campaign is receiving from lobbyists. That might be something I want to do, and this isn't going to give me that answer.
Yeah, and I think the answer to that question, and I think it's an important point, because a goal of the statute is to provide the public with accurate information. In the floor colloquy, Senators Obama and Feingold discussed this very question and suggested what I think is the right answer, which is, as Joe said, that the commission designed the form so that each lobbyist is disclosed as having raised the entire amount at the event, and that the form also lists the other lobbyists who were the co-hosts. So the public knows that when they see $150,000 for lobbyist A, it'll also reflect the names of lobbyist B through G or whatever it is. When they see that same $150,000 disclosed for lobbyist B, they will not double count that money. They'll know it's the same money, it's just attributed to multiple lobbyists.
Thank you for asking the question. If you follow that interpretation, that $15,000 threshold has zero meaning. There's no point in having it in the statute. Essentially, what the statute should have said is, no matter what, if you raise more than one, if you bundle two or more contributions, you got to disclose it. So let's take your numbers, and let's use some other easy numbers, and let's say everybody on the 50 lobbyists that each raised $2,500. That's a real example. There are tons of those where people in their personal capacity, and it's sometimes personal money they're raising, that means that it's going to be disclosed as 50 times $100,000. It is incredibly misleading. It is incredibly inaccurate. It renders meaningless the $15,000, and whatever Mr. Simon says, it will not only be interpreted mistakenly, it'll be reported that way. And the Center for Responsive Politics and Common Cause and those groups will take that number and they will put it out there in the public domain in the misleading fashion. And I mean, I've seen it. They take numbers that are apples, oranges, and pears, and they lump them all in together and put them in as an apple. That $15,000 was a product of compromise. It was in neither the House nor the Senate bill. And the requirement that the candidates disclose it and not the lobbyists is very material as far as accuracy. The LDA does not mandate accuracy. You round to the nearest $20,000. You do the best you can on specific issue areas. They took it out of there, and they put it in your accounting regime. So you cannot go that direction unless you basically want to make that $15,000 a completely meaningless provision.
I just have one quick follow-up to this discussion. There is some legislative history. We've spoken a great deal about Senator Feingold and Senator Obama and Congressman Van Hollen and the statements they put on the public record. There's some additional legislative history that that we've been looking at. It's the section-by-section summary that was put together by Senate Majority Leader Reid and also Senator Feinstein, chair of the Rules Committee with jurisdiction over campaign finance law, and Senator Lieberman, whose committee has jurisdiction over the LDA. And they included a statement in their summary of this bundling for Section 204 of the bill dealing with bundling. They say, an event hosted by a registered lobbyist may trigger the disclosure requirement if the committee credits the lobbyist with the proceeds of the fundraiser through record designation or other form of recognition. Would seem, from my reading of that particular legislative history, that there's a contemplation that that word may, that the disclosure is going to be dependent on how the committee itself is going to credit the how those proceeds were raised. So I think that the point that Mr. Jenkins brings up, there is some legislative history that would appear to support that reading.
Well, and to that point, you're not going to get credit from the committee for $150,000 if you raise 15. It's just not the way it works. They're going to have a list that says you raise this much. Now, where I agree to sort of say let's pierce the veil is if there are 10 people at 15, or let's say 11 at 15 to, quote, evade it, if there are other means of designating, in other words, if there is a record or there's a code number on the checks, and I'm one of the 11 and I have 17,000 in my column, that's a bundling reportable event. But in the absence of any other way to ascertain who did what, I think you just have to divide it up by the number of sponsors.
If I can respond to your point, Commissioner, I mean, I just don't read that statement of the section by section is inconsistent with what I'm arguing here. I mean, you can imagine a small fundraising event co-hosted by a few lobbyists that collects $12,000. It doesn't trigger the threshold in that event. The event would not be subject to reporting. And I think that's consistent with the statement, and the statement doesn't really address at all the question of whether the total proceeds of the event should be attributed to each co-host. And again, the floor statements of Senators Obama and Feingold do very expressly address this point.
What about the situation where, let's take an event that raises $30,000, you have three lobbyists. First lobbyist shows up with $20,000 worth of checks. The other two show up with $5,000 each. To metaphysical certainty, we know those are the facts. Then the campaign's going to file a report under penalty of perjury that says they each are credited with $30,000. That seems to be kind of an inconsistency there. How do we deal with that situation? Well, it's not a million-dollar event or 11 lobbyists or any of these other situations that are very real situations, but something that actually does happen. Somebody shows up with more checks than the other two guys, and the other two guys are essentially going along for the ride and are not being credited by the campaign for they had 20 grand, they're only being credited for five.
Yeah, it's a good question.
Thank you.
Well, it's a hard question. I just think in the fundraising events are sort of a special case of bundling, and I think they're that's the way they're discussed in the legislative history. And I just think with a fundraising event, you've got a sort of objective indicia of who's responsible for raising the money. The co-hosts are sharing in the publicity of the event, their names are associated with the event, and I just think the clearest public record will be created by not getting into a kind of subdivision of the amounts prorated among them by some methodology, but just attributing the full amount to all of them.
But even though the statute seems to talk about how the committee or how the member credits it, even though there may be an appearance issue, it's really the crediting. I mean, could the report have maybe somehow an entry for $30,000, a memo entry saying these three people sponsored it and maybe break down? It just seems to me the report needs to be accurate, not a guess, but yet disclose that there were three people who hosted the event, even though maybe individually they would not trigger. Is there a way to do the report that would actually be a little bit more closer to reality if we know that? We don't want people filing false reports because people are going to rely on these. But on the other hand, we want to probably get at the situation you're raising. How do we? Can we do both?
Well, the sponsors also made it clear that this system is to be based on the money that's actually brought in. I mean, I think in the situation you mentioned where people are hosting an event and to be on the host committee, they had to. Say write or raise 15 and somebody falls short, they're not going to be credited for it. I think the situation we're talking about is where they're all recognized as co-hosts of the event, and the more realistic situation, if there's 25 different individuals and they're all each has to raise $3,000 and that's what they're not going to be considered in no sense of the word credit are they being credited with the whole amount. I think the situation we're talking about is where there's a couple of people who are co-hosting event and that the full amount is credited on the committee's books. And in that situation, said in the comments, it shouldn't be prorated. The whole amount should be, you know, should be credited to them.
With all respect, that never happens. I mean, if it's a $30,000 event, the books don't reflect $60,000 worth of receipts. And I think your example, Mr. Chairman, is a great one. Very clear what the disclosure should be there. The person that raised $20,000, where there is a means of recognizing that, there's a tracking mechanism, that person gets disclosed as having bundled $20,000. And the other 10 doesn't show up until or unless those lobbyists do more fundraising within that reporting period, and they trip the $15,000 as individual lobbyists. The word aggregate is not used in the statute. The word aggregate was used in the Senate provision. And again, it's a wish list of legislative history. They lost on the bundling provision. It was a very heated debate. It was the single provision that was holding up enactment of that statute in Congress. And what emerged was none of the above. And that's very notable from a legislative history standpoint. That's, you track the evolution of the statute, that signals unequivocal intent. And to do it, I mean, how you're going to say for the 3,000 times 30 equals 90, we're not going to disclose that, but we are going to disclose 10 times 3 equals 30 as 30. That's just inconsistent. And you have to be accurate, and from the public record standpoint, it will be incredibly misleading. Notwithstanding memo entries and asterisks and all of that, nobody reads those. And what they want to see is, wow, $1.5 million was raised by X company PAC for this guy. Well, that could not be more inaccurate. And there will not be $1.5 million worth of credit attributed to that PAC, and it completely undermines the global accuracy of those records. You said, let's say they, in total, raised $3 million in the cycle. Well, that's not going to sync up with this $1.5 million on a separate schedule. I don't think you want to create schedules that are inaccurate.
Could I just briefly respond?
Sure.
Please
do.
I think it would be a surprise to Senators Feingold and Obama that they lost on this legislation. I think there is a way for the Commission to design the forum to make it clear how the money works, to make it clear in the case of fundraising events that they're shared responsibility, and to make it clear that the amount attributed to a fundraising event should not be double or triple counted. I think that's really just a matter of draftsmanship and how the forms are created.
To the extent any commenters have an actual formal suggestion, I'm happy to take supplemental comments on how to actually do the form. I don't want to have forms that we know people are signing under penalty of perjury that are arguably not accurate. So if there's a way to do the form, that may help. But I want to actually go to the General Counsel, who may have some questions, since we're getting a little short on time. But
given the time, I just have one follow-up question. I wanted to revisit the issue of under what circumstances a non-lobbyist employee of a registrant, under what circumstances the reporting rules would cover that individual. And Mr. Standler, I think, has suggested an objective test with a set of presumptions. And Mr. Jenkins, you have suggested using the volunteer standard. I just have a practical question about that. How does the reporting committee know when the individual is acting as a volunteer or acting on his or her own behalf or acting on behalf of the registrant, particularly in the example that you give in your comments, which has to do with an administrative assistant who's sort of pressed into taking fundraising action on behalf of the registrant?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a difficult mechanical issue to navigate. I think any of the solutions that have been proposed are very difficult to sort of get your arms around from an enforcement standpoint. I guess what I would say is, you know, it's on the committee, it's the burden on the committee. I think that the committees are pretty sophisticated, and if you have PAC manager, for example, in the title of the bundler, or you have as the person who's doing the work the administrative assistant to the vice president for government affairs, I think that creates a reasonable inference that there's some evasion going on there. It's not perfect, I grant you, and I understand the concern you've raised.
Mr.
I'd just like to make a comment. Who's present here today is Bob Lenhardt, our former chairman, who worked very hard at this NPRM, and we give him a lot of credit for the hard work and the thoughtfulness that went into this. And it's great to see you here. I want to make one other comment. We never have talked about the situation where you can have a lobbyist and five people who are co-hosts are not lobbyists. And at that point, things can get watered down quickly. And I'm worried about the arbitrariness of an automatic pro rata superseding any other method of credit here. And we don't have time to go into it, but that's just a thought that nags me on it.
Why don't we do this? Actually, does the Office of Staff Director have anything?
I don't.
Okay, thank you. Why don't we hold the record open for a week for supplemental comments in the event that people have things to follow up on, whether it's a suggestion on how to report or to address actually that concern, because that was one on my list of what if you have one lobbyist and a bunch of other hosts, does that still mean the lobbyist is automatically credited or can it be prorated? Because for me, it's more of practical how we implement this statute. So the record can be held open for 1 week without objection. No objection then. So ordered. With that, it is the time for this panel has expired. On behalf of the commission, I want to thank the commenters. I think that's been very helpful and really helpful to me, and I'm sure I speak for all, very helpful to all of us. And thank you for your time and your effort. And with that, we are going to recess for 13 minutes and reconvene at 11:30 for the second panel.